Welcome to The Fighting Priests, a podcast exploring orthodoxy and jiu-jitsu. Two paths, one struggle. Father Ted Perestivopoulos and Father Thomas Sandberg are two orthodox Christian priests who also happen to be practitioners of jiu-jitsu. Together, they explore how these two unique worlds intersect and what it means for our spirituality. Here's Father Ted and Father Thomas.
You know, I have been thinking about this for a few months now, and I want to recognize that what I'm about to say, you know, I don't have the experiences of tremendous trauma in my life, and I haven't been attacked or had family members attacked or anything like that. So I want to be sensitive to that as well. But we've been talking about it here, which is the idea that, you know, the person who murders or the person who attacks or the person who steals, the person who is most hurt in that situation is probably the soul of the person who's done the murdering.
100%. Right? Yeah.
Like if we think on that sort of grand, the timeline of God, so to speak, right? Yeah. The death of the innocent, well, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints, right? Yeah. Like there's something precious about that and important in a sense about that. And that's what makes it so tragic, right? Is sort of that lost innocence perhaps of that person. But the damage that does to the soul of the person doing the act, right? That's also something that we have to take into account. And, you know, one question we could ask is, what is our responsibility in a situation like that in terms of caring for that person's soul, right? I don't know exactly how to answer that, but that's been something that's going through my mind.
Well, I would answer like a parent. And what do I mean by that? Well, you have a little baby now, right? She's 1 year old.
Yep.
I have three children. They're a little bit older, right? My twins are 11. My other one is 8 and a half. And it's like, well, children, what do we do with children? If I see them going to do something bad, right? I try to stop them. Not that I want to coddle them, because sometimes they need to learn through falling. But if they're going to go do something bad, it's like, I obviously as a parent encourage them and say, slow down, don't do this because this is wrong and this is going to have consequences, right? And I might even have to force them to stop doing, like, let's say, don't hit your sister, don't hurt this person, don't, because it's wrong, right? So I with my authority and with the power that I have over my children, because I do have power over my children, right, as a parent, I guide them gently and sometimes not so gently, to be honest, so that I can protect them from doing something worse. And now when we look at our fellow human beings, yes, our fellow human beings may not be children in that sense. They may be adults. Of course, they have their own agency. They have their own free will. They are culpable for their decisions, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're under duress. Sometimes they're under mental health problems. Sometimes they might be under the influence, right? There's a lot of different factors where our brethren are not in their right minds. And it could even a spiritual problem. It doesn't have to be drugs or mental illness. It can be a spiritual problem. And so again, if I have the choice between letting them run amok and doing whatever they want, right, and hurting people, or stopping them for their own good, then I'm going to stop them for their own good, right? Mm. And then of course, I think it's a no-brainer when we talk about like what is the lesser, like sometimes the lesser two evils. Like if you have somebody. Like, you know, you have the extremes, right? Like if you have a gunman, right? You know, going into a school, which unfortunately we see more and more these days, right? And you're a security officer, well, and the person's not stopping, well, it's still a sin to kill, right? Mm-hmm. It's still a sin to use deadly force. But what are you going to do? You're going to let the person kill a bunch of kids? No, right? So obviously you're going to do what you have to do under a horrible situation, right? Mm-hmm. To save as many as you can. Mm-hmm. You're in the army. You're a chaplain in the army, right? It is the same thing. Like you have men and women who are serving, and they are not there because they are bloodthirsty, because they are horrible human beings. They are training to be measured. They are trained, but they are training to also use lethal force in the defense of something greater, mm-hmm. right? And some people have a problem with that, of course. Mm-hmm. But as Father Thomas always says, like, you know, for you to have the luxury to have a problem with that, those people are required, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think we have to, it's a much more complex situation. I think even for priests, like, I don't think we're exempt from it just because we're priests. Right.
Right. And we should be, and this is the other thing, you know, I'm 4 years into my priesthood now, and there are certain things, like one thing I've thought a lot about because I've had people like you and others who have guided me in my education and in our friendships is, if you're going to be the way to be a good priest is to be a, first of all, just a good human being and a good Christian. And one of the ways to do that is to, for lack of a better way of putting it, develop those aspects of yourself that are underdeveloped, right? So the physical aspect of my life, I'm pretty intelligent. I enjoy music. I like to perform, right? That aspect of myself is quite developed, but the physical aspect is not that developed. So like diving into that, part of the reason I'm doing that is because I think that someone who is put in a position by the bishop to be an example and to lead a group of Orthodox Christians should be somebody who can be somewhat conversant, at least in a lot of different aspects of human life, right? If a catechumen comes and they've done martial arts, I'm like, okay, well, here's something I've done. They come and they're an opera singer. I'm like, well, I'm not an opera singer, but let me tell you, I've been on the stage as well. And, you know, obviously the physical training is one small facet of human existence, but it was one that I was blind to. Right.
Yes.
So being able to train in a lot of these things, I think, makes you a better priest. So in a way, priests are just under more pressure to be good Orthodox Christians. Right. So I think that's probably what we're talking about here, is how does a good Orthodox Christian sort of engage with these kinds of tension filled situations?
Sure. Yeah. It is complex. Right. And it's, but I'd rather grapple with it than avoid it, right? I'd rather deal with it. And because I never thought of these things before I did jiu-jitsu. Like, I thought about it a little bit as a priest, as a theologian, as a professor, things like that. I thought about them like on an academic level. But until you embody it, right? And
until someone's choking you.
Yeah. Until somebody's sitting on top of you and trying to break your arm, right? And you're completely helpless.
Did I tell you the story of one of the first times I was rolling with somebody? He was practicing this thing, and he goes somewhere. He's like twisting my arm back. I don't know what these terms
arm
are.
Armbar, yeah.
And armbar. He's like twisting it back, and it, man, I already have bad shoulder and arm flexibility. Like my chest, my shoulders, my back, my upper back, and everything is really stiff to begin with. So like, you know, stretching them even further back, he's stretching it out, and he just keeps going, and he keeps going, and then he kind of ends, and it's a little awkward. Silence, but then, you know, I do my thing, and then he comes in again and does the same thing. He's pulling, and he says to me, he's like, do you know how to tap out? I was like, what?
What's that?
Yeah, I had no idea what it was. So he kept pulling because I wasn't tapping. I didn't know that tapping was a thing. No one had taught me that. So I had endured like a whole bunch of like yanking my arm as far back as I could. And you know, it was a good stretch. It was a good stretch. Sorry, I interrupted.
You're lucky you didn't break your arm. Tapping should be covered in a fundamental class day one, you know?
So there was clear oversight by some. Maybe it's one of those things that's so ubiquitous and so commonplace that everyone just assumes that everyone knows that when you're done, you tap, right? Yeah, I had no clue. Like he was very kind. He knew that I was relatively new. Obviously, like,
and that's why he didn't put it on like hard, because he could have broken your arm. That's why it's called an arm bar, right? Like, right. It's like you break at the fulcrum, right? Like right here. Yeah. It's. Until you're in those situations, though, you don't contemplate it in the same way. And it was only until I started doing jiu-jitsu and I started really contemplating. I'm like, you know, what does it mean to be an Orthodox Christian and to say you believe in Christ and you believe in humility and you believe in meekness and you believe in forgiveness and all these kind of things? But then at the same time, how do you reconcile that with even some of the saints we have, right? Because we have like warrior saints. We have saints who did things that, you know, according to our modern sensibilities are horrible, right? And are not very saintly, right? You have St. Demetrius, you know, praying, right? For Nestor, you know, to beat Laius in the stadium, right? So it's like, what's that all about? It's like, oh yeah, go out there and kill him. There's a lot of, that stuff in history, and we kind of overlook it because we don't want to think about it. But it's like, then it comes down to, you know, somebody had asked me once hypothetically, right? They're like, well, Father, you know, I was having not an argument, but like, you know, debate about this with another Orthodox Christian. And they're like, well, you know, you can't, you know, what would you do, Father? You know, like Orthodox priests can't kill, for example, right? Like in the canons, it says that if you've killed another human being, you cannot be an ordained minister. Or if you do it under any circumstance, even if it's like, it doesn't really say anything about self-defense in the canons, but if you have killed, then you're not supposed to be, you know, offering the sacrifice at the altar, right? Fair enough. So this person posited, of course, an extreme question to me. He's like, well, you know, if you're sleeping at night and somebody breaks into your house and they want to hurt your family, right? Mm-hmm. Would you defend your family? And I said, of course I would. That's like no brainer. Mm-hmm. Because again, the innocence that is placed under my care, my wife, my children, mm-hmm. of course I would place myself in harm's way to protect them. And then of course the person followed up and said, well, would you kill to defend them? If it took like, because it's easy to say, maybe it's not easy, but you know what I mean? It's easy to say, I will protect them by giving my life, right? But in that kind of situation, if you die, your family's next.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they're not stopping at you, right? Yeah. If the person knifes you or shoots you.
Well, the person comes in, they break into your house, and then they present you with a contract and say, if you die, I promise not to kill your family. Would you sign that paper? And then.
Yeah. I'll just take your stuff, right? But like, as long as I can just kill you. Yeah. It doesn't work like that in real life, right? So, so they say, well, you know, if you had to kill, you know, would you do that? And don't you find that against your faith? And I had to think about it for a while. And then my answer was, well, I would kill to defend my family, right? Because A, it's the lesser of two evils, right? And B, and he said, well, if you did that, then you wouldn't be able to be a priest. And I said, well, that's what you got to deal with.
Yeah. Those are the consequences.
Those are the consequences of your actions. And I would pay it gladly.
Right.
In Canada, In Canada, you would go to prison because in Canada, you can't even defend yourself according to our legal system, right? Even in a self-defense, there's a very high probability that you could go to prison or get sued into destitution, right? Because just unfortunately, the way our laws are. But I would pay that gladly if it meant my family would be alive.
Right.
Right. And they'd be safe. So, and is that the antithesis of Christianity? I don't believe it is. I've had to think this through for quite a few years now, right? Mm-hmm. About like, what does that mean for me? Like, you know, would I be a failure as a priest if I couldn't serve at the holy altar anymore because I had to do this thing? And I would say, well, no, because that's the way life went and I had to make a decision. And that was the best decision that I could make in that particular instance mm-hmm. with the least amount of evil mm-hmm. that I could do, right? As horrible as something that would be, because nobody, I don't think anybody would want to be in a situation where they would have to kill another human being, right? Take a life. Mm-hmm. But is that an antithesis of Christian life? I don't believe it is. I think that Christian life is all about making the best decisions that are dictated to, we're guided by the gospels, guided by our spiritual formation. And then we take that and we make the best decisions in a lot of crappy situations.
Well, that's what you're describing is wisdom, right? And what you're describing is what the reason why the scriptures are not a systematic theology that has rained down from heaven, right? What they are is stories. And these stories don't present you with clean moral systems and moral questions. What they do is they present you with stories of how different people through the story of the scriptures dealt with situations. And in a recent podcast, you and the guest used the metaphor of like, well, a chessboard, right? There's how many pieces, 24 pieces or whatever. And then you can calculate the amount of moves and there's a finite amount of moves, but it's still so intensely high that it's impossible to even count the amount of moves that could be made in a chess game. How much more, how many factors higher and more is that in jujitsu, which, you know, like every single, you can't train for every single situation. What you do is you train skills and you adapt and you improvise and you enact that thing in that moment based on the situation there. And you're using your best judgment, your best wisdom. And wisdom is an embodied knowledge. So jujitsu is so much more than chess in terms of the amount of different moves that can make. Now imagine human existence.
Right? Yeah.
The amount of unique situations that come up are so unfathomably huge that the best thing that God could give us is a series of stories about people who have gone through situations, right?
Yeah, and because relatable. It's relatable.
Right, right. And we can extrapolate from that principles of wisdom, because it would be impossible to teach us every single correct moral decision in every single situation. But a lot of the times that's how we frame our moral questions. Well, if this happened, what's the right answer? And if this happened, what's the right answer? And I think that that's just not a good way of approaching moral questions. It's to say, what story do you live by? right? Yeah. What story do you let inform you, and what story do you embody in your life, right? And focusing on that. And yes, there will be moral successes and moral mistakes. That yeah. Those are going to happen, even with those people who are following and living by the story of the gospel. But then, of course, as you said, when we make those mistakes, we come to confession and we accept the penance that the church gives us, and we move on with our life as best that we can. So I personally don't get too hung up on sort of the minutiae of the moral situations and the questions. What I'm more excited about is, what story animates you? What story do you sure. look to help inform what kind of decision you'd make in that situation?
Yeah, it translates in the same way when you're learning jujitsu. You're going to see this if you haven't seen it already. But some of the best instructors, they don't focus on techniques, although the majority of time you learn techniques, right? Especially at the beginning. But what happens is that eventually what will happen is a good instructor will focus on concepts. And you'll hear this probably. If you haven't heard it already, you're going to hear it in the future. As you progress in your jujitsu, they're going to say, well, you know, we are teaching concepts, right? Not techniques, because concepts are kind of like the overarching idea of what we're doing here, right? So, you know, like if you're, let's say you're practicing back takes, right? So, you know, you start, you know, positional sparring, you put your hooks in, you sit behind the guy on the floor, you put your seatbelt in and you're just sitting there and you kind of start from there. It's like, okay, well, we've taken the back now. And now from there, sure, there are lots of different minute techniques you can do to choke the person, to switch to an arm bar, to do a lot of different things from that position. But the concept of how to control the person from the back, right, with your hooks on their legs and to control the torso and to control the neck and all that kind of stuff, those main concepts don't change, right? You have to control the hips. You have to control. So in jiu-jitsu, it's like the main concepts are, right? Takedown, right? Pass the guard, control the hips and the torso, right? Get inside line and then do a submission, right? These are the broad strokes of jujitsu. And then how you get there, you know, it's like, okay, takedown. There's a myriad of takedowns you could do, hundreds of them, if not thousands of different takedowns that you can do to get somebody to the ground, right? You're never going to learn them all. You're never going to perfect them all. You're going to learn even a phenomenal black belt will hit maybe like 3 or 4 takedowns and that's it. But they do them so well, you can't stop them, even though you know what they're going to do, right? They're just so proficient at it, right? And a good, you know, and that there's tons of passes you could do to pass the legs, right? To pass the guard, but you're not going to learn them all. You just can't. The concept is I need to pass, right? And so how am I going to do that? There's Toriendo pass. You're going to learn all these different passes, right? There's knee cuts. There's over under. There's all these different things, right? And you're going to learn what works best for your body, and you're going to do that, right? And then when you get to side control or you get to mount or whatever, right? There are a number of things you can do from there. You're not going to do them all, right? So same. So it's kind of these basic concepts. And when I was a white belt, when I started, I didn't understand this. So I was focusing on techniques, and then you're writing them down and you're trying to keep a catalog. That's not, like you said, that's not the way to live your life. You can't do that because then you're like, I'm not a computer to access at that moment. Okay, if this happens, this is, right? And it's the same thing with morality. You know, we have the concepts that are given to us by the Gospels, as embodied through stories, through narrative. And then we hope that by familiarizing ourselves constantly over and over again with the concepts, and then trying to embody those concepts through spiritual exercise, such as fasting and going to church and things
right,
like that.
Right.
Right. We do so we embody it just like in jiu-jitsu. It's like, you know, you learn the technique, but then you go drill, right? You drill, drill, mm-hmm. drill, drill, drill. Mm-hmm. You know, you drill. 2/3 is drilling, 1/3 is rolling. It should be. That's the ratio, because the drilling is so important to embody, to like get it in, you know, to kind of know it just in your sleep. And then when bad things happen, like you said, you just react, right? In jiu-jitsu, you just react. In a bad situation in life, you would react according to your morality. So yeah, somebody breaks into my house, I'm going to go into protection mode no matter what. And because I know that I've already kind of thought this through, and I know that the hierarchy of morality in my life, this is, you know, what the altar of protection is, bang, 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 like, you know, and you just do it. You don't just sit there and say, oh, okay, and then freeze and not know what to do, right?
And it's informed by your practice of fasting and your practice of prayer and your practice of embodied liturgy. Like, you know, those things that we do, we don't do them just for fun. Actually, most of them aren't actually that fun. You know, fasting is difficult. Prayer is difficult. Attending services is difficult. But we do those things as very much as a rehearsal, right? There are things that train us in our second nature. And you know, there's the topic of like quandary ethics. Okay, so here's a quandary. A lady's walking down the street and a train is coming at her, but you have a lever, right? Like those are quandary ethics. Here's a situation. Now let's fill out our ethics based on the situation. Whereas an orthodox approach would be something like, okay, here's the situation. What would you do? And then the question would be like, well, tell me about your practice of fasting. Tell me about your prayer life. Do you attend services, right? Like we would go to those things, right? What are the things that are banal, right? The things that are everyday. How do you embody that gospel story in your life? And then, I don't know if this metaphor makes sense, but let me know what you think of it. But morality is downstream of the gospel.
Yes.
We don't start with morality.
No, it is the end result. Like it's the byproduct.
Right.
Right. It's what manifests from what you already have inside of you. I like the example you said. You talk about, like, for example, you say, oh, you know, what if you saw somebody starving and then, you know, you were hungry too? Would you share your food and this and that? I'm like, well, do you fast? What does that have to do with it? Well, if you fast, then you know how to control hunger, right? You know how to control your stomach. You know how to not eat for a higher purpose, right? The person who fasts is more likely, I would say 1,000 times more likely, to share their food with someone who is hungry or to sacrifice their food than a person who doesn't fast, who's more likely to look out for themselves first, the survivalist attitude, right? So you're already conditioned from years of fasting to do that moral action, to take that moral action,
right, I guess you could say, right?
It's the same thing. Like, it's the same thing when we're talking about training. It's like, if you know, if you've done it 100 times under pressure, you'll do it. If you don't know it, then you're gonna fold. You're gonna run away. It's just the way it is. That's the difference between a soldier and a person who's not a soldier, right? When the enemy's coming, sorry, enemy, cut you off. A soldier is trained when they see the enemy coming, they don't run away. They run towards the enemy. It requires a certain amount of conditioning, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Right? Like one of the metaphors that's coming to mind is one of driving. Right? Like every time you get in the car and you drive into the supermarket, like if you think about it this way, you've never, ever done that drive before. Even though it's you've gone the same route and it's the same supermarket you go to every time.
Different factors, of course. Yeah.
Yes. Every single time you go, you've never done that before. So what you're doing when you're driving is you are spontaneously improvising your training in a real life moment. Right. Yes. And if you're a good driver, you're somebody who's trained, you're somebody who has practiced these skills, and you don't know what's going to come up. Maybe the light's going to be out or somebody's going to cut off somebody else in front of you, right? And you have to it's very interesting to think about, but you spontaneously improvise based on your training. Just like a jazz musician, like a very tight jazz group, they are all, often when I tell people I'm going to improv practice, they're like, well, why do you have to practice improv? Don't you just make it up? And, you know, on one hand, it's quite funny because that is what we do. We just go on stage. We don't have a script. We just make it up. But on the other hand, it's like, no, you actually have to be more practiced, more rehearsed, because a really tight jazz band, they can read each other. They know the scales better than anybody. They know how to weave back and forth, not only themselves playing, but they're playing with other people. So they have to match what other people are doing. Well, that's sort of what's happening when you're driving. You're spontaneously realizing a moment, right? And bringing your skills to bear. Well, that's how morals work in an orthodox context, right? Like you bring all of your skills that you've developed through years of fasting, prayer, attending services, all those other things that we do, so that when you encounter real life situations, the decision you make, at least the wisdom that you're putting into making that decision, is informed by a healthy spiritual lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Right? It might end up having been perhaps the wrong moral decision, maybe, but you know what? You did your best. Right? You're trying your best. You're living that life, and that's what the church and the community is there for. Because we will get it wrong, right? Like we will get moral decisions wrong, but that's okay. Like there's forgiveness in the church and there's repentance and there's penance and there's these mechanisms that we have to re-welcome people into the life of the church. So I don't know. It's a bit more freeing. I'm not so worried about making the wrong decision, if that makes sense. I first worry about the training. But yeah, I mean, jiu-jitsu is a great example of exactly how this works, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point. Like the idea of not worrying about the actual, when the time comes of the decision you're gonna make, but rather the training. I compete, right? And maybe one day you will compete, maybe you won't. It's, you know, something like 5% of jiu-jitsu practitioners actually compete, right? But I strongly recommend it. Why? Not because you want to win medals, but because it's like this ultimate test. It's like all your training, everything you've done culminates when you step on a mat with somebody you don't know who they are in a competition. You've never seen them before. You don't know who you're fighting. And then basically it's that ultimate improv, right? It is. It's the ultimate improv because, and it's nerve wracking because you don't know. When you're in the dojo at your own place, right? You get to know your friends, you roll with them every day, multiple times a week. You know what their style is, you know what to do well, and you play, right? Sometimes they catch you, sometimes you catch them. But when you go to another dojo, when you go to an open mat somewhere, or you go to a competition, you don't know. It's the ultimate improv. So it's all that skill, all that training that goes into now this you know, competition, this fight that you're going to do, where you have to improvise on the fly, and you have to bring all your skills to the forefront, right? But you got to flow, right? This is what, and we use this term in jiu-jitsu, you got to flow, right? And to be able to flow properly, and to be able to be effective, right? And it's an ultimate test of that. And when you first start competing at the beginning, you're a disaster. Everyone's a disaster because you're not good at it. You're not good at flowing. You know, you're still in that mode of, you know, which toolkit do I use, all this kind of stuff. And as you get more mature and the belts and things like that, it's a different experience, right? Mm-hmm. And so it comes to bear with that. But then even, and this kind of last example, I guess I'll use, because we're well over the one hour mark today.
It means we're on flow right now.
Yeah, we're in flow, exactly, right? Is that beyond like just the idea of like, you know, the competition bringing out who you really are, like how well you've trained, like, you know, what are you embodying in jiu-jitsu? Just like when calamity strikes in life, it shows you how much you embody orthodoxy, you know, how much you've actually absorbed into your soul, right? Because it comes out, right? And if there's nothing there, then nothing comes out, like nothing orthodox comes out, as we saw in the pandemic, right? Lots of us, you know, the way we reacted, some people reacted in an orthodox way, some people reacted who are orthodox in a very secular way, because that's what's inside of us, right? That's what comes out. That's what we've cultivated, right? At the competition, it shows also the way you are as a person. Like I once somebody asked me, like, you know, if I'm in a competition, let's say, right? And I put a person in an arm bar and they don't tap, would I break their arm to win the gold, right? Some people would say yes, because we're in a competition. Everybody has, you know, everyone knows the rules, right? They've signed up for this, right? And so it's not immoral to keep going because they haven't tapped, because they know they're caught. They know they can't get out. And because of ego or pride or whatever it is, or they think they can get out, they don't tap, right? And then you break their elbow, let's say, right? And it happens sometimes in competitions. Doesn't mean somebody's bad or whatever, right? But would I do it? And my answer, my personal answer, this is not an answer for all Orthodox Christians doing jiu-jitsu. My answer is no. Because I don't need that medal enough. Like I don't need, like if I have somebody in an arm bar and I know I've won the match, I know I've won the match. Mm-hmm. I, you know, my jiu-jitsu has been better on that particular day and I know I have won, and the person won't tap, I will let go. And if it means losing for whatever reason, let's say I lose or they get on top of me and they get some points and I get a silver, so be it. That's the decision that I made, because in me, my personality is, I don't need to break somebody's arm so that I can win the gold, so I can prove that I'm the best, right? For somebody else, they might just do it because they see it in a different way. They say, well, you know, yeah, like we all signed up for it. We know what this thing is. We're going hard. We want to, you know, go to the point to see who's the best. And that's just the way it went, right? So all this stuff kind of influences what kind of a competitor you're going to be. You know, there's people out there who are mean. There are people out there who are aggressive. And there are people there who are teddy bears, right? And who are just really kind individuals. I remember, I know you're new to jiu-jitsu. I don't know how much you follow anything online or other.
Not much. Dipping my toes into that stuff now.
You will. But like, you know, there's some big names in jiu-jitsu. There's a lot of big names in jiu-jitsu. There's like lots of different practitioners. And as you get into it more, you will get to know them. So like, you know, I guess two of the biggest, you know, names ever. One of them is, you know, Marcus Buchecha, who's, you know, who's like one of the top heavyweight, you know, black belt competitors in the world, has won, you know, in his division, you know, the most, some of the most, I think the most probably world championships, right? And he retired from regular jiu-jitsu, and now he's gone into kind of like a little more MMA, right? And he's killing it there, right? And then there's another guy, Leandro Lo. Leandro Lo was, again, in his weight division, slightly lower, one of the best in the world, right? Brazilians, both of them. And they were really good friends. And the reason why I bring this up is because it's just a heartwarming kind of like touching story, and it shows your morality, right? So unfortunately, Leandro Lo died last year. He got shot in the head in a club by a police officer who was off duty and drunk. Just shot him in the head in Rio de Janeiro, 31 years old, prime of his life. And he was one of the best, Leandro Lo. And they were friends with this other guy, with Buchecha. And I was watching a documentary about Buchecha and his rise and things like that. And it was showing how, like, these two guys, even though they were best friends, like, they, you know, they were also rivals, because sometimes they would fight in the same weight class, you know, and whatever. So at one time, they were, you know, they were in this big competition, IBJJF Worlds, right? And it was like the Grand Slam, which is like, you know, it's like, it's a really big thing. And so you win a certain amount. And if you win this one, it's like you win everything, right? And they were kind of like both winning their fights. And then Leandro Lo, he dislocated his shoulder in a fight right before the final that he would have fought with Buchecha. So he dislocated his shoulder. He still had won on points, right? But his shoulder kept popping out. It was really gross. And it was like, popping it back in, whatever. So then they had to like tape him up, you know, like whatever, under his gi. He had his hand inside. He couldn't fight the final. I think it was the final, the absolute. It doesn't make a difference. And so Buchecha, even though, you know, he had to fight him at the end, but because and he would have had the Grand Slam, but he went and spoke to the judges. And then when they went on the mats, he instructed the judge to give it to his friend. Right. So the judge lifted the hand of the guy, of Leandro Lo, who had his shoulder dislocated. Right. And Leandro Lo got very emotional because, you know, it's like Buchecha could have taken the championship. Right. But out of respect for his friend. Right. He gave it to him. Now, that shows a lot of character. You don't see that a lot in jiu-jitsu. You see it, but, you know, you don't see it on that level where somebody gives up like a massive thing out of respect for the other person, right? Because they're hurt, and that's what I mean. Like, what's inside of you comes out. It's not always about winning, right?
And it's in that moment, jiu-jitsu is not an idol, right? I think like sports can become an idol, right? It becomes the end in and of itself. But they recognized in that situation that actually there's actually something more important than this, right? There's a higher goal or a higher purpose that jiu-jitsu can serve. And I think that's another way that Orthodox Christians can engage with jiu-jitsu is not to see it as something that's in competition with Orthodox Christianity, but seeing it as anything else in this world that's created, whether it's literature or movies or whatever, that these things can be okay if they're properly nested within that gospel story or the towards the highest good. If this the small story of jiu-jitsu is properly nested within the grand story of the gospel, then to me, that's why I have no qualms about jiu-jitsu.
And on that, that's a good way to finish, because you wrapped it up with a bow.
Exactly.
And yeah. That was a good one. And because we are way over our time, but I don't mind, you know, to tell you the truth, we've been like about an hour and a half. This might be a two-parter. It might be a two-parter.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
Yeah. We might do it like, you know, I have no problem with long form podcasts, but maybe we'll split it up. Maybe do like, you know, 40 minutes and 40 minutes, do a two-parter, because I think it was a really wonderful conversation. I don't want to cut any of it. It was really, really fun to talk to you, Father Yuri.
No, I appreciate it, because I'm still so new into the jiu-jitsu world that like having these conversations helps me. Like, I haven't thought through this as thoroughly as you've had to think through it, just being in it for however many years now. So it's useful for me to gain that wisdom from you. Not only the grand wisdom of the morality of the church or something like that, but also just like hearing some of the terminology and just like, oh yeah, that's what we're talking about. Oh yeah, that's what this is. That's what this is. Like something as simple and banal as, you know, full guard. I was like, oh yeah, what's full guard? Okay, I got it again, right? So it was a useful discussion for me on many levels.
Awesome. Well, on that note, we'll end it today. And I do. So I pray that you will have a continued journey, because the reason why I say that is because we know that the attrition rate in jiu-jitsu is very high. I think something like 10% of white belts make it to blue on the average. A lot of people do not last because it's hard, right? And the thing that is hard is the thing that is worth doing, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, do the thing that is hard in life. That's always gives the most fulfillment. And so I pray that you will stick to it and you will be consistent and you will never give it up, because it is a lifestyle. It is something that you integrate into yourself, and it can be a beautiful journey, a parallel journey along with your journey in the priesthood. Right. And I hope that we get to roll together, because, you know, I can come down to Hamilton one day and visit, and maybe when you're up in Toronto, you know, you let me know and you come by the gym, and it would be nice to kind of roll with you and also have you on the podcast in the future again. So
yeah, that'd be great. Just let me get a little bit more training in before.
Well, of course. Yeah. Don't worry. I'm a puppy dog. It's like, I'm known as the gentle giant. Maybe it's my nature. It's like, I'm big guy, but, they get me to roll with the newbies because they know I'm not going to hurt them. So,
right.
The gym. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's the way you do it. Right. Yeah. You don't have to use your weight. Right. So, yeah. So thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Yeah, and God bless you and your ministry and your continued ministry and the ministry both at the parish and also in the military as well. It's an important position that you have. So I do thank you for that. And to everybody else listening to our program, we thank everybody for following us and listening. And we hope that you are all well and continue to train safely and faithfully. And we will see everybody in the next couple of weeks. Till then, take care and God bless everyone.
You have been listening to The Fighting Priests. Feel free to download us on Spotify, Apple iTunes, or anywhere else you get your content. Check us out on Instagram at The Fighting Priests. And if you have any questions, feel free to email us at thefightingpriests@gmail.com. Till next time, keep training the body and the soul.